Hello and welcome to the Brentas Foundation podcast, where we throw light on some of the African continent's biggest and most pressing issues and leverage best practice, not just on what to do, but how to do it. I'm your host, Marino Ongokulo, and it's good to be back in your ears. Happy New Year, if I can still say that. It's exciting to be able to share parts of conversations I have with some of the most learned, driven, and hopeful minds the continent has ever known. Today, we'll be talking about the making of food. By that, I mean agriculture and agricultural policy. Now, wait a second, stick around, because lucky for you, and I mean real lucky for you, we have a purely engaging and well-versed guest who did a fantastic job breaking down the challenges and opportunities in this area, especially as it pertains to South Africa. I'm so excited for this conversation and can't wait for you to hear it. So agriculture, as we all know, remains an essential sector in boosting economic growth, inclusion, and job creation in South Africa, as it does in many other countries on the continent. And yet, for a lot of us, you would find poor policy implementation, weak government capacity in delivery of like infrastructure and basic services, as well as a lack of collaboration or poor collaboration between government and the private sector, have been sort of relentless handbrakes on people's livelihoods, of the social fabric of communities, and the country's economic output. These are things that need to change. These are things that need to be done differently. And my guest has some ideas about these. And joining me today is Wandile Shishlobo, who is the chief economist of the Agricultural Business Chamber of South Africa and the author of two books, A Country of Two Agricultures, The Disparities, The Challenges, The Solutions. And his second is Finding Common Ground, Land Equity and Agriculture. Wandile is also a senior lecturer at the Department of Agricultural Economics at Stellenbosch University. He's also a visiting research fellow at Wits School of Governance. And one of the more interesting things to me is Wandile was also appointed as a member of President Cyril Ramaphosa's Presidential Economic Advisory Council in 2019 and again reappointed in 2022, having served on the Presidential Expert Advisory Panel on Land Reform and Agriculture from 2018. So he's definitely an interesting person to speak with, and I'm so excited for you to hear this. So without further ado, let's hop straight into the chat with Wandile. So Wandile, welcome to the Brentas Foundation podcast. It's good to have you here. How are you doing?
Thanks for having me on, man, and Happy New Year. I hope it's an excellent one for you, and importantly, that you managed to get some rest.
Oh, you're too kind. Thank you. Thank you. I managed to do exactly that. It was fantastic. I hope you got some rest too yourself.
I did. I needed it at the end of last year. So I managed to be offline a bit, which was excellent, in the Eastern Cape.
Yeah. Oh, perfect. Perfect. That's excellent. All righty. So to get us into the episode, I thought maybe we could play a very quick game to familiarize the audience with who you are. You ready?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, so what was the first job on your resume or CV?
I think the first job that is there, I'm not sure if it's on my resume, but I definitely got paid to do it, was being a tutor at the university. So that's the first time I actually had a bit of a good income at the University of Fort Hare, assisting in the economics courses and some agricultural economic courses to the first year. So that's the first thing I was there. It was excellent.
Oh, amazing. Amazing. Okay. Do you have any hobbies or skills that most people don't know about?
I'm not sure if most don't know, because I mean, I've like tweeted about this, but I like hiking a lot. So it's more of a hobby. So yeah. I generally check for many places. But the one other hobby that I'm not sure that many people know is that I listen to a lot of hip hop. At any moment, like, for example, today, I'm always been looking on my Apple Music and knowing the scheduled albums that are to be released. Those are always give me great moments. Even as an agriculturist, we drive around the country a lot, and those long distances are for podcasts and those music. And so
Oh, that's exciting. See, that's definitely something new, and I'm glad we're speaking about it on here. Okay, so what is one skill that you underestimated that has served you really well for work?
I mean, I think what has been helpful in terms of work is more on writing. And perhaps at the start, I didn't really pay a lot of attention on it. And I think when I look back now, it has been really excellent. But I think there's a story, though, that most people don't know. They would see like a kind of like lot of pieces that you put out. And I'll hear people say, oh, yeah, you are productive. You are doing X, Y, Z and stuff when they read things. But if you were to think back on the earlier pieces, there are people that know how hard it was for me to actually get to put the piece together. I mean, there's a friend of mine, Pandeep Bai, he's an economist, and some of the friends of mine, Bronwyn Norke, she's a writer and also in economics, and Songhez Ozibi, who's now a politician at Rise, I think Phakamisa Nzamele, are some of the few people that helped me a lot at the start. And when I think about the first piece that I ever wrote, I mean, it must have been like 700 words for the business day. That took me a month or over a month to put it together. So it's one of those things where people look at it now and think that, oh, it comes easier. I'm like, I don't know about that. It has not always been easier, but it is one of the skills that I look back now and I think it's been excellent.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree with you more. It really is a fantastic tool to have. Okay, what was the last aha moment you had and what was it about?
Ooh, my goodness. I don't know. That means I haven't been thinking deeply enough recently. Nothing comes to my mind. Yeah, it's been one of those periods.
I'll let you think about this, and I'm sure something will come to mind before we're done. The last thing I have for you before we get into the episode is, when you hear sort of Africa in 2050, what comes to mind, or what's the first thing that comes to mind?
I mean, Africa 2050, the hope for me is that we are out of the current difficulty of always being a continent that needs to be assisted. In as far as the food, agricultural productivity, rural economy, the whole hope is that we could see this sector of our economy as a continent playing a much more robust role, and us coming out of the hunger trap that we see in so many African countries. That's what I hope for when we're thinking about 2050, given the space that I spend most of time in.
I am silently but loudly clapping over here. That's fantastic. Oh, Wandile, thank you so much for indulging in this game. To sort of get started into the main sort of topic, right, talking about agriculture and agricultural policy, to sort of frame the discussion, maybe let's start with, what is South Africa doing and getting right in the space of agriculture and agricultural policy? What comes to mind when we talk about, you know, something that's going well?
I think South Africa has had a period where we were doing a lot of things right. And it's easy now to be pessimistic about operating conditions in South Africa because of all of the challenges that we see at the ports, where the ports have deteriorated in their efficiency severely. The roads and the railway lines have also deteriorated in quality. There's rising crime. There's also geopolitical tensions, and all of those things, they sap away the energy. But I think to answer your question, it's always good to take a 30-year view and look back and say, thinking from 1994 up until to today, how has the South African agricultural economy performed? And when you take that horizon, you begin to have an appreciation that this sector has more than doubled in value and in volume terms from 1994 up until to today. Then this brings us to your question of saying, what has been behind that improvement? What are we doing right on policy? And you appreciate that the key things that we are doing well are aspects around adoption of technology. So the private sector investing a lot on technological development, but also paired with the government that is open on registering a range of those agrochemicals that are needed, a range of those better seeds, better genetics that are key for improvement. The second aspect, which I would also credit both the government and the private sector, is opening up the export markets. For a period, our trade policy was really progressive. If you think back on the early 2000s, all the way, I would say, up until late 2015 or so, we're opening up aggressively many export markets to an extent that when you look at South Africa's agriculture today, it is we are exporting roughly about 50% of what we produce in value terms. So what we've been doing right, in essence, is being on the forefront of technological adoption, being on the forefront of opening up the export markets for our products. And I think those are some of the key policy successes that we've had over the past few years. And I would add and say, also just not doing anything is helpful in a way there. What I mean is that a government that doesn't interfere with the markets and, and allow the private sector to operate effectively is something that perhaps maybe we take it for granted, but it has assisted a lot in the growth that we've seen in South Africa.
Yeah, no, that's a fantastic point to make, actually. And I think it's one of the things that comes up in a lot of the work that we do. It's like sometimes, you know, it's like take your hands off it and stop interfering. And that actually is quite helpful, more beneficial. So thank you for highlighting that. So Wandile, as sort of an expert, right, in agricultural economics, you've definitely gained sort of valuable insight into the sector. Could you share some sort of specific lessons or insights from your experience that you believe has the potential to transform South Africa's agriculture positively? If we are looking at the context we are dealing with today in 2024, what are some of these experiences that, you know, can really transform the status quo in agriculture?
I think some of the key things, I mean, I write about this in my latest book, A Country of Two Agricultures, where I say, look, we are still stuck with an agricultural sector where you have a largely commercial, progressive side of our sector, mainly white farmers, and then you have black farmers being on a smallholder, non-commercial side of the sector. Then the question is to say, how do you begin to marry this sector so that at least, yes, you will remain with dualism to an extent for a long period, but now this dualism should not be represented on a racial dynamics. That's the one aspect of saying, how do you curb around that dualism on a racial basis? The second aspect then that is also important in the conversation is of saying, are there any other areas at which we can see this sector growing and on what I like to call expanding the South African agricultural pie? And where we see some of those possibilities for growth is on the land that is currently owned by the South African government. The state sits with around about 2.5 million hectares of land that could be put into full production. In the former homelands of South Africa, agricultural revolution is yet to take place there and also assist in changing fundamentally the economic conditions of those areas. And I think if those things can be done, which in essence of saying, how do we bring into production the land that is currently underutilized in South Africa? The numbers that we have ourselves here at ACBIS, the Bureau for Food and Agricultural Policy, and my colleagues at Stellenbosch University's Department of Agricultural Economics is that we could see the gross value added of this sector expanding by anything between 15 to 30% if those things could be done. And along that, we could see also employment increasing in agriculture and in the agro-processing space. So those are some of the possibilities that could be done. The question then lies to say, who should be doing what? And I think that is something that the government needs to begin with, of saying, let's release the land. Once we have released then that land, let's look into saying what are some of the partnership approaches that can be done in selecting the beneficiaries and putting them through the incubation. And there are a range of successes in South Africa at PELS, at Sonic Group, and many other agribusinesses. Those are things that we could be done. So in essence, this is a sector that is still on a growth trajectory, and that expansion is yet to take place.
No, that's fantastic. And I'm glad you went there, because another question that I have in mind is we know some of these things, or quite a lot of them, actually. This is the work that you and, as you mentioned, colleagues at Stellenbosch and in other places have done, and you have put out publications and briefs and things of the sort out there. And some of these things I'm sure have informed policy. So Wandile, I'm curious if you have any thoughts that you would be happy to share about why is there a gap in terms of these policies and then the practical implementation of them. What do we need to know or understand about the gap between the policy or the theoretical element and then the practical implementation? Why is it taking long? Why are things not happening? I'm curious to know what your thoughts are on that.
Mary, if I had an answer on that, I would have resolved the problem. Because I sit in a space where I advise policymakers, and as the Agricultural Business Chamber, we're sitting in a policy space. So that's always a dilemma that we deal with. Mm-hmm. But I may make a few observations or aside, where I think the first aspect that I think it remains a challenge is always the alignment of vision between what the private sector desires, what the government desires, and what the local stakeholders understand and desire. If we can have an alignment of vision about where we're going, that's the first part that we need to get right. The second part is also understanding that policy is usually done at a national level, but the implementation is local. Then we have to ask the question to say, do we have the human capital and the know-how at a local level to be able to execute the ideas that are coming from a national government and the national structures? And in our experience in South Africa, we've come to learn that at the municipalities and local governments, you realize that a lot needs to be done to improve their capabilities. There's a huge gap on them on this. That's the other aspect. There is also something to be said about the communication of these policies from a national level to the local level. By the time they get there, you realize that the message is no longer the same. I mean, I've had instances where I sit in Pretoria and listen to conversation, then move to Bishore, which is the capital of the Eastern Cape, and listen to policies. Then from the capital town of the Eastern Cape, you move to a small capital city of the Eastern Cape, you move to a small town within the province, say in Flagstaff, and you listen to what people are saying in Flagstaff as an example, and you realize that the conversation is quite different. So yeah, there is a lot that needs to be done on and making sure that there is a clear collaboration from the local as well as a national government, and the skill set is there. And I would end that by saying also trust needs to be improved at a local level as well, not only just to say the business leaders and Pretoria are sitting together, building trust, but then the question has to be, are the people at a local level also seeing in the same eye with the people that are working in government there? Because they are the collaborative structures that needs to be implementing these things. So those are some of the aspects that are there. And all of these things happening in an environment where there's this mistrust, there is corruption, there is rising crime. So these are all create what I would call friction in that implementation route. But I think these are some of the aspects that as South Africa, we have to get through them and have that collaboration at a very local level so that the policies and the programs can be successfully implemented.
No, that's fantastic. Thank you for that. And, you know, one of the points you mentioned about, you know, the national level versus local level, and talking about, you know, improving capabilities as well as addressing the communication, like, because I definitely understand that. It's like one thing is said in those offices and you go to the ground and you're like, actually, that was not what happened. I'm curious. It was also one of the things you mentioned, right, when I was going through your chapter contribution in the book, Better Choices. Can you share a bit about what that could look like if, for instance, that was left to you, Wandile, to try to address or to fix? What are some of the things we need to be thinking about, we need to be doing about? Is it also entirely technical in terms of improving, you know, their capabilities and capacities, or is it also political? And how do we need to think about, like, the practical resolutions to addressing some of these issues?
Mary, thank God my job is only thinking, not to implement anything.
Help me here, Wandile. Help me. I believe in you. Let's go.
But I think where I would start this thing on, I mean, I had a great mentor, God bless his soul, Mohammed Karan, Professor Mohammed Karan. He liked starting some of his things at a philosophical level to make sure that there's an alignment of vision. And I do think that coming up with an idea, setting it on a policy, and first making sure that you really mobilize the support at a national level, and then you go down on the local level that you are targeting, mobilize the support and make sure that there is a broad buy-in is always a first and important step to take. And then I think the second step then begins to be more at a practical level, where you must make sure that there are accountability steps when certain things were supposed to be done and they are not done. There has to be accountability step so that people are really driven and they deliver their goal. That accountability is not only just on the government officials, but also for the private sector partners that are saying, look, we will assist you on implementing XYZ. You put the carrots there on saying these are the incentives that you will get. But also there could be parameters to say, okay, guys, if we don't meet certain deadlines, XYZ are some of the things that we may have to look at. So those are all things that I would say I put in. But I would start philosophically on communication, and then making sure that there's an accountability metrics which is linked to an M&E on that process. And I would close that by ensuring that, I mean, look, instead of going with a menu when you do with these things, it always helps to take three or so things and make sure that you are prioritizing them over a period of time. That mm-hmm. earns you credibility, because people will see you delivering on those programs, see the results. And then when you move to the next step, then even those that had been sitting on the side and have lost a little bit of confidence on the government, they begin to say, look, maybe let's go to the table. We've seen them doing X, Y, Z. Let's go collaborate and let's change the issues on the ground.
Yeah, no, that's one. See, you're already solving these problems. it's fantastic. So one other thing I was hoping maybe we could talk a bit about was you talked about improving, right, rural infrastructure. Can you speak a bit about sort of the deficit in this area, and what are some of the ways we need to be thinking about how to finance some of these like key infrastructure that not only just, you know, allow access into these areas, but also opens up the market to different kinds of opportunity?
Yeah, I mean, look, the financing part is something that I really think that, and hoping that the Brenda's Foundation can bring someone in here on the call to touch about and talk about those things, about agricultural finance on an infrastructure, but also just agricultural finance on a farming side, because I think it's something that is so important. And in South Africa, we haven't paid enough attention on that for various reasons, because we had other things that were present, but I think it's important. But on your point about the infrastructure, I would put it in two segments. The first segment being the fact that we have existing infrastructure that is crumbling, and as a result of incompetent municipalities, corruption and all of those things. So, and that presents a range of challenges. I mean, a few years ago, we all heard about the example of Clover that was leaving Lichtenberg to go to KZN because the municipality was super unhelpful. And in Mpumalanga, we hear daily of the super unhelpful municipalities that are presenting a lot of pressure to businesses in there. And that's something that has become a story of South Africa. So there's a lot of improvements that needs to be done on the governance side of the municipality. And if that is done, then the maintenance of the roads, the maintenance of the water, the power supplies, those are all part and parcel of those things that needs to be maintained. The second part of the agricultural infrastructure relates to the provinces that were outside of the Union of South Africa, the former homelands, basically to say. And those provinces have remained at the periphery of agricultural progress for some time. And when you ask the question of saying what's going on there, you realize that there's a lack of infrastructure in as far as silos, in as far as road networks, in as far as water, even on connectivity. So those are some of the things that needs to be done. And I will close off that by saying there's also something to be said about soft infrastructure, which is the institutions that assist in making sure that people are mobilized and grouped together and chasing for a particular a vision that they are doing in their city or in their town to drive and actually achieve and see the levels of programs. Those are all of the aspects that I think we need to put in place for us to see economic progress, particularly within the agricultural sector in rural South Africa.
Wandile, I'm just here and you've taken me to the classroom and I love it. I'm over here. I'm like, I am learning so much from this conversation and I really appreciate you sharing all these things for me. One thing I wanted to bring up as well, which you sort of alluded to before was, right, so land reform, land rights, right? This is a major point of conversation, contention sometimes, even here in SA. Can you share a little bit about sort of the historical challenge there and speak about what it would take to address land reform, at least for agricultural purposes, and to strengthen some of these land rights for South African farmers?
Yeah, I think many observers of the South African economy or South African society in general, I mean, they're familiar with our history and the nuances of it with regards to the land question. But I think what's more important today is the fact that we no longer where we were in 2017, where there were discussion of expropriation without compensation, and many people were really uncomfortable about the trajectory the country was taking. There were fears of investment plight, and all of those things. But if you look at where we are today, to say what's the thinking, in as far as the policymakers, what I gather from the leadership of the country and in the Department of Agriculture is that there's more now of an appetite of saying, how do we drive investments into agriculture in South Africa? And that entails then on first looking at the state and saying, how much land has the government bought that is sitting in its books? And an example of it is the program I mentioned earlier, saying we have what we call a PLUS program in South Africa's agriculture, where the Department of Agriculture, Land Reform and Rural Development has accumulated quite an amount of land since, particularly in a period between 2006 up until now, because prior to that, some of that land was released to beneficiaries with title deeds. From 2006 coming into now, very little has been done on title deeds transfer. There's been many land leases. The point then and the policy question at the moment is around of saying, can we release those to beneficiaries with title deeds? And how do we begin to select those beneficiaries, which is where we have what we call the beneficiary selection criteria of selecting the people that can use the land productively. It is through that effort where we can be able to see the agricultural sector growing in a more inclusive way, to the point that I made earlier, to say transformation is not always about taking from a white farmer to a black farmer, but it's also about how do we push forward on growing the sector more inclusively and grow the agricultural pie. And that's where the discussion is at the moment. And the leadership is more keen to move forward with the release of that land. And who knows, by the time this podcast comes out, maybe the announcement would have been out. We shall see. But the point is, we have moved away from the unproductive conversations on land reform in South Africa. Mm-hmm. And that, though, doesn't mean also that land will now be stopped, being released. Land reform will stop within that 2.5 million hectares. The state may continue to buy land. And I think the other important thing to put forward as we are having this conversation is that when we look at the progress of land reform in South Africa, 1994 to today, people usually circulate numbers in the media where they say black people now own only 9%, 6%, all kinds of figures that you see being circulated on social media. In our research at the Department of Agriculture Economics at Stellenbosch University, we think land reform is at somewhere around about 25% of the 30% target of that was set in 1994. So there is progress, but it's not, of course, at a desired pace. And much of that land has not been transferred. It's the one that is sitting with the state. And we are saying now it needs to be transferred. While that is happening, all of the other programs of land reform continue, because we have about three legs, tenure, restitution and redistribution. And all of those needs to continue as this land is being released. So that's where the discussion is that amongst businesses, and also from what I'm listening and I'm hearing from the leadership of the country around these aspects.
Yeah, that's very helpful context, and I sort of appreciate that distinction as well, because as you said, yes, a lot of the time you don't really hear about the fact that some of this land just sits with the state, and now I guess it's figuring out what to do with that. So thank you for bringing that up. The penultimate question I had for you, Wandile, is, you know, there's a growing interest, right, in involving the youth in agriculture, and how can we encourage and support support the younger generation to actively engage in agriculture as a sector, right? Whether that's directly in research, whether it's actually in farming, and to basically contribute to the agricultural sector. Are there specific opportunities or initiatives that you've come across or that you think are interesting and that people could explore a bit more?
Yeah, I think there is space for young people in agriculture. And I mean, many people typically make the point of saying, let's make agriculture sexy and all of that. And my take would be that let's make the agricultural sector more profitable. And I think one profitability aspect is there, then we can be able to see more young people coming into the sector. And because at the end of the day, when you look at our sector, you look at the other sectors of the economy, what becomes important to people is to say, which sector can they be able to make a living and earn a living on it? And I think once the agricultural sector has reached a level where it is more profitable, you will begin to see more young people participating in this sector of the economy. So that for me will be one aspect that I think we should all strive to see happening in this sector, because it does have a prospects for growth. But I think to attract young people to get into it, let's make it ensure that the profitability aspect is clarified. The second aspect that I think is also equally important is on clarifying the ways at which the young people can participate. How can they access land? Where should they be going? And also to emphasize the point that when we talk about participating in agriculture, we're not only meaning that be involved as a farmer. We do need some that are farmers. We do need some that are operating within the value chain of the sector. There's a much more areas of work that young people can add their efforts in the sector, within the value chain, within the services side, and within the farming side. And I think those are all things that needs to be there. But the infrastructure to support young people to be part and parcel of that is something also that needs to be put in place. So those are things that I think we should be seized with and thinking a lot about as we look into the sector of our economy.
I couldn't agree more with that. Thank you for sharing that. And the last question I have for you, okay, you know, it's a bit two-sided, so I'm cheating a little bit, is the first is, I'm curious, Wandile, can you share a little bit about where the interest in agriculture came from? And the second question that I have is, obviously you are a researcher, you do a lot of work in this space. What is currently keeping you preoccupied in terms of, you know, agriculture as an area of study? What are you working on? What are you thinking about?
Yeah, so I mean, I've recently released a book called "A Country of Two Agricultures," and that's been doing reasonably well. I'm very grateful to the people that have supported the project. So that's something that we've been sitting and walking and on the road sharing with people, but most importantly, listening to the observations of people when they have utilized the material, telling us about how they think about that. That's the moment of reflection on that. And of course, thinking about these questions around the implementation, because the book outlines what do we need to do to close the dualism and grow the South African agricultural sector. But what's more important now is then sitting on the ground and also observing about where the improvements needs to be made. But I think the most worry for me at this moment is possibly onto two things. The first one is the changing geopolitical environment and what does this mean for agricultural trade? Because as South Africa, we are a sector that is export oriented. So these changes in the geopolitical environment matter a lot for us. So that's the one aspect that I'm thinking a lot about. And I'm also thinking a lot about the infrastructure gaps in South Africa and the logistics and all of those things. They are a great difficulty that are confronting us. I would say those are top of the mind issues, aside from some of the things that are in the new manuscript that we are writing, because that book is out. And now I'm trying to see if do I have anything else to say in the next material? But that's the conversation for another day on that. As to where the source of courage about continuously being involved in a sector, I mean, look, I'm a South African, and we're struggling with about three problems in this country. We have an issue of high unemployment. And it's devastating to drive across the country, walk across the streets and see what's happening. And we have an issue of higher poverty and of course, the low growth in rural South Africa. The idea then is to say, what else can we do within the area where we have training on or where we have ability to contribute, which is in agriculture, to try to resolve those problems or those triple challenges of problems of poverty, low growth and unemployment. And that's the one thing that one finds a source of courage of saying, look, let's continue to work here. And I spend a lot of time trying to be useful in questions around that and the ideas on hoping that one maybe one day can have a moment of epiphany and have an idea that perhaps would fundamentally change things for the better in that area. So that's where the inspiration for involvement in the sector comes from.
Wandile, this was more than everything I imagined this conversation to be. I'm extremely grateful for the time, and it's always a delight learning from you. So thank you so much for doing this with me.
No, thank you so very much for having me on for the second time. So, yeah, appreciate this.
Yeah, no, it's always awesome.
That brings us to the end of today's show. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did putting it together. I love learning new things. Hey, if you enjoyed this chat, you definitely enjoy others that came before it. Check out previous episodes on whichever platform you're tuned into now, or visit our website www.thebrentisfoundation.org for other episodes. As always, thank you so much for listening. And if I could make one last ask of you, please do share this with others. Again, you're listening to Marie Noel on the Brentis Foundation podcast. And it's been a pleasure sharing this time with you. Until next week, stay well.